Welcome to Lecture 16. I hope you are all enjoying this series and the topics that we are exploring. Please feel free to ask any questions that you have about parenting and behavior management of children with special needs by calling in and leaving a recording of your question. I'll be happy to address them in the order that they arrive to me. So here's a recap of the list of the 15 lectures that we've done so far. First, we talked about what comes first, behaviors or emotions. Then, we discussed doctors' predictions. We introduced ignore negative behaviors and separate without comment. We answered questions about adolescents and preemies. We talked about staying organized and consistent, and we explored sibling rivalry in children who are typically developing and children with special needs. We also discussed children with ADHD and how their needs should be addressed. Then we headed deeper into phase one of the Handsful program, INB, ignore negative behaviors, SWC, separate without comment, and missions in greater detail, using adapted versions of the Are Your Hands Full audiobook, Volume 1. This should have given you a jump start to actually start the Hands Full program, preferably on one child at a time. It should have clarified for you what to do during negative behaviors, either INB or SWC, and how to avoid direct commands for the first phase of this program by stating missions instead. We then moved ahead and added more outlooks and insights that are relevant while you might be implementing phase one of the Handsful program, and delved even deeper to some of the phenomena you might be experiencing while working through phase one, notably the expected outcome that your child's behaviors will likely get worse before they get better when you start this program. During last lecture, we moved into a new topic. Honest communication with children. Today, we are going to add some additional concepts that are related to working on, obtaining, and maintaining an honest relationship with children. But first, a quick detour for a question from a caller. The question was asked as follows. What do I do if at the Shabbos table, my child keeps on saying, stinky, stinky, you're stinky, you're stinky? I tried to take my child away from the table and put her on the porch and closed the door. But when I bring her back to the table, she keeps saying, you're stinky, you're stinky, you're stinky. Okay, not a chuppah problem. That's for sure. There's no cursing involved here. This is very unpleasant, but it's not a disaster. So here's the answer. Since our caller didn't mention any particular diagnosis attached to this question, I'm going to address it the way I would address it for a child who is developing typically. This is clearly an attention-seeking behavior. This child is clever enough to know how to hijack negative attention at the Shabbos table, because in general, the Shabbos table is a time where all children learn to share the attention that they are getting from their parents. But if this particular child is trying to get attention and has difficulty tolerating that other children exist, and require attention at that time, the child would surely be smart enough to use a shock factor negative behavior to paralyze the rest of the members of the table and stop the proceedings of the Shabbos table. Very neat. Very smart. In general, because I'm so afraid of any covert messages sent to a child that you're chas v'shalom not welcome at a Shabbos table, I do my best to get parents into the mindset of surviving a few Shabbos meals where the word stinky is in the environment. I know it's not appropriate. I know it's not pleasant. I know that you're afraid that your other kids are going to start saying stinky, stinky as well. And yes, that fear might materialize. But I promise you that if you and your husband take it upon yourselves to simply not hear it at all, even from your other children, the behavior will die out. Unfortunately, when you separated your child from the table, you accomplished a few negative goals. Number one, The child learned that there are times that she's not welcome at the Shabbos table, which is a little bit scary looking forward into adolescence. Number two, the child was locked out of your house. I'm never comfortable with locking kids anywhere unless we're dealing, chas v'shalom, with a safety concern. And three, for some reason, this child viewed being separated from the Shabbos table as some form of attention and therefore continued the behavior after you brought her back. So I'm going to ask you to survive six Shabbosos like this. That's 12 Shabbos meals. I practically promise you that it won't last that long. Imagine you have a guest from Australia, a niece or a nephew that you are doing a tremendous chesed for and taking into your house. You're clothing him, you're feeding him, you're housing him. But you're not responsible for chinuch, so you really don't care. You also appreciate the beautiful opportunity for your other children to observe you totally ignoring this behavior. You will be very pleasantly surprised to see how quickly your other children and this child will drop these behaviors because there is no audience for them at your Shabbos table and in your home. And now moving forward with today's lecture. Our first topic is a quick one. How and when children make choices. Once you understand this very quick concept, you will understand how to be more direct with your children without offering choices when you don't really mean to give the choice, and how important it is for their safety and security for you to call the shots during the first decade of life, unless the choice at hand is completely inconsequential and both options are perfectly acceptable. Let's take a listen to this snippet from Are Your Hands Full? Volume 2. Young children are not developmentally ready to make choices because an individual must be able to weigh the pros and cons of a particular decision before arriving at a conclusion. When neither option of a decision is perfect, the individual must use the gray area of thinking to weigh the pros and cons rather than using the simple black and white area of thinking. When young children are asked to choose, and neither choice can be squarely classified as all good, white, or all bad, black, they become confused and insecure. Therefore, parents of young children should make decisions for their children and follow through with them. Parental decisions and carry-through create a safe and stable environment for the young child and simultaneously cultivate the chinuch goal of establishing and maintaining authority. At the onset of the second decade of life, teens begin to develop the ability to make choices because the adolescent's ability to weigh outcomes and choose intelligently emerges as the brain develops the gray area of cognition. Choices allow teenagers to feel independent and to develop the ability to think options through, predict outcomes, and choose correctly. Bear in mind, though, that the gray area of thinking that is necessary to make healthy decisions develops slowly, and thus, it is wise to limit young teenagers to uncomplicated choices that have simple and minor outcomes. Do your best to allow your adolescent to make decisions about which you are equally comfortable regardless of the choice they make. Additionally, once you give teens the choice, refrain from making any suggestions or from attempting to manipulate their decision in any way, which would sabotage the choice-making learning process.
So now that you've heard that little piece on when and how children should be allowed to make choices, let's move on to the correct way to understand and handle when children appear to be lying. Take a listen to this little piece from the Are Your Hands Full audiobook, Volume 1.
It is crucial that parents understand that children ages 6 and younger cannot clearly differentiate between fantasy and reality. And children who are younger than 6 wish something to happen, they are able to fantasize and truly believe that it actually happened. Lying is based on an accurate perception of reality. An individual states an untruth despite the fact that he is aware of the truth.
Children who do not have an accurate perception of reality are not lying. They simply blend fantasy with reality and imagine situations that they believe occurred. Children who display dishonesty at this age should not be viewed as liars, but rather they should be recognized as normal children with active imaginations. I just had this with Libby the other day. He came home from school elated. "What happened in school today, Libby?" I inquired. "You won't believe it," he said. "On the way home from school, I saw the president." "Really?" I said. "How did you know that he was the president?" "Well," said Libby, "he was driving a really fancy black car, and then I saw that he was wearing a black suit with a pin that had a flag on it. So I knew for sure that it was the president." Libby wasn't lying. His imagination dictated to him that this was the president, and therefore in his mind, he really saw the president. When this type of scenario occurs, this mother can try to help Libby differentiate between fantasy and reality by stating something like, "That's a nice thought, Libby, but the president is a very important person and he usually does not drive around by himself. Also, anyone can wear a suit with a flag pin on it, so the person you saw probably wasn't the president." At the age of 6, the transition to recognize the distinction between fantasy and reality begins. This is a slow process that develops gradually over time. Stealing. Children under the age of 6 do not steal. A child whose understanding of ownership is not yet developed should not be classified as a thief. As children mature, they begin to develop an awareness that objects can belong to others and that taking an object that belongs to someone else is wrong. Children who do not yet understand ownership sometimes fantasize that desired objects truly belong to them. A child under 6 who displays such behaviors should never be viewed as a thief, but rather should be recognized as a normal child with an active imagination. I remember when something like this happened with Mindy. I was looking through her knapsack for any leftover lunch or school projects, and I noticed an expensive toy that was definitely not hers. When I asked Mindy where she got the toy, she said, "Rifki brought this toy to school, and I loved it so much that she told me that maybe she would let me borrow it. So I took it from her knapsack during recess." Mindy did not steal. There was simply a conflict between Mindy's imagination and reality. This mother may introduce the concept of ownership to Mindy by saying, "Mindy, this toy is not ours. It belongs to Rifki. When a toy does not belong to us, we must not take it unless the person to whom it belongs actually gives it to us. Tomorrow we will return it to Rifki." By stating that the toy does not belong to us, this mother is teaching Mindy the concept of ownership. Mindy may still not grasp this concept fully until she is approximately 6 to 8 years old. I was working in the kitchen and Yossi ran into the house, made a mad dash for the bathroom, and ran right back outside at an equally fast pace. He did not flush the toilet or wash his hands. Right before he got to the door, I stopped him in his tracks. "Yossi, did you flush the toilet? Did you wash your hands?" Yossi looked up at me and said, "Yup," and continued to run out the door. Why did Yossi lie? Didn't he realize that his mother already knew the truth? Yes, Yossi realized that his mother knew the truth, and that is most probably why he lied back to her. Our mother implied a lie by asking a question as if she did not know the answer, when in fact she did. Children are professional mimics, and when the mother lied by asking, "Did you flush and wash?" Yossi learned from her and lied right back to her. When we ask someone a question, we are implying that we do not know the answer. If it is obvious to the child that the parent knows the answer to her own question, then the child perceives the inherent dishonesty. Since children mimic us, they will copy their parents and lie in response. So don't ask if you already know the answer. The best way to prevent this type of dishonesty is by not asking questions when the answer is apparent. Rather, our mother should have simply stopped Yossi and said, "Toilets should be flushed and hands should be washed." If you don't know the answer, If you honestly do not know whether your child flushed the toilet and washed his hands, then you may ask the question. At that point, however, you must accept your child's response as truth. If the child says that he flushed and washed, then allow him to return to his activities. If later you discover that the child did not say the truth, the behavior should be considered a lo sase behavior, and during phase one, it certainly should be ignored. Over time, if you demonstrate trust in your children by always accepting their responses as true, most children will respond to your expectations of honesty and will live up to the standards of truthfulness.
Okay, so that changes things. Now that you get the idea of what the exact profile of young children's fabrications is, you will be far more equipped to understand what is going on when children appear to be lying. Another form of couching the truth from children, which often takes place over years and years of their upbringing, is when children are bribed to do everything we want them to do. Somehow, when this happens, children don't get the idea that when they're doing the right thing, it's because that thing is right. Rather, they get the dishonest message that what they are doing is because it's going to be worthwhile for them in the end. Although there are some times, as we will see, that there is a legitimacy in offering incentives for children to engage in certain behaviors that are important for them developmentally, exclusive use of incentives creates a generation of children who are way too self-absorbed and self-centered. Let's give a listen to the section from Are Your Hands Full, Volume 1, on bribes and their implications.
A bribe is a gift bestowed in order to influence the recipient's conduct. Although bribery seems to work, it actually breeds an atmosphere in which compensation is routinely expected. Instead of following a directive because a person in a position of authority has requested it, children who are exposed to repeated instances of bribery lose their sense of obligation to obey an authority figure. They learn to obey only if the reward is worth the effort. As adults, we are guilty of this Chinese auction mentality as well. In the past, giving tzedakah was done for the sake of the mitzvah itself. If a collector came to the door or an envelope came in the mail, people gave money solely for the sake of giving tzedakah. Today's organizations, on the other hand, must create creative methods to convince people to give tzedakah. They realize that people will only donate if they feel that they are getting something worthwhile in return. Therefore, they organize Chinese auctions, offer instant prizes, and provide incentives that indicate that those who give more will receive more. It is an unfortunate state of affairs that many people are only willing to give on the basis of what's in it for me. Giving for the sake of giving is almost non-existent in fundraising today. Although Hashem does give us schar for doing mitzvahs, it is not always apparent and it is not always immediate. Hashem did not set up the world so that every time we recite a bracha, a $100 bill floats down from heaven. We are expected to perform mitzvahs without necessarily seeing the schar, because Hashem said that we should. Furthermore, there are concepts such as tzaddik v'ra lo, rasha v'tov lo, when a good person is struck with tragedy, rachmana litzlan, and an evildoer encounters success, which indicate that sometimes a good person appears to be disadvantaged in this world without receiving any apparent reward at all. Yet, in spite of this, we are still expected to do things correctly. Unfortunately, children are raised with an expectation of reward for a good thing that they do, and they are often resistant to obeying unless it is worth their while. They are given charts, stickers, and prizes for every manifestation of positive behavior. After receiving an excess of stickers, children lose motivation and are sadly unaware of the intrinsic gratification inherent in a job that is well done. Wouldn't it be more worthwhile to teach children to do things for the sake of the reward of knowing that something good was accomplished? My daughter was born with multiple disabilities, and the doctors gave up hope for her future. Yet, after 21 years of tremendous hard work and siyata deshmaya, she got engaged, married, and built a family. During that time, there were many intelligent individuals who asked me, "How did you know that she was going to get married? How did you know that she was going to have healthy children?" I was flabbergasted each time this question came my way. Why did people assume that I knew? As far as I could tell, I had not been blessed with prophecy. So I could not comprehend why people would assume that I knew that she would ultimately marry in the future. Of course I didn't know how her life would unfold. How could I? For months I tried to understand why people were asking me this question. Finally, it dawned on me that people were operating on the assumption that if I had not known the positive outcome of all the hard work I had invested, I would never have devoted such superhuman effort to her growth and development in the first place. Therefore, they assumed that I must have known that I would get some reward at some point, or else why would I have bothered? This realization caused me a great deal of sadness and distress because it illustrates that people indeed live with the Chinese auction mentality and will only validate effort if it is met with an equivalent amount of visible gratification. This principle applies to all areas of life. Adults make optimal choices when they focus on what's correct rather than on what's easy or what yields the best or most instant gratification. We must raise our children to connect to this important value by helping them learn how to carry out our directives. The subliminal and subtle message should be based on the fact that they are doing something that is correct rather than on what's in it for them. Bribery, as stated in Devarim, Perek Chaf Gimel, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Ki Hashochad Ya'aver Eine Pikchim, because bribery blinds the eyes of the wise, does not only refer to adults. Bribery blinds the eyes of our children as well and distracts them from learning the lessons that are integral to our chinuch. Now that we understand why bribery is wrong in theory, we can begin to discuss why it is wrong in a practical sense. As a rule, a bribe is always phrased as an if-then statement. This implies choice. For example, if you clean the playroom, then I will give you a candy. In this example, the child can choose to clean the playroom and get a candy, or not clean the playroom and not receive the candy. By implying that there is a choice, children are being allowed to make an independent decision regarding the bribery option, even though the parent actually intended to command the child to clean the playroom. Frequently, parents become upset with their children when they choose not to accept the bribe. However, the child is not at fault since the parent presented two valid options. Often, parents disguise bribes by using an after-then statement. Yes, I remember an example of that. I often announce to my children on Shabbos afternoon that after the playroom is clean, we are going to Bobby. Although the after-then statement seemed to have avoided the implied choice of the if-then statement, in actuality, the problem remains. Let us imagine that the playroom is still not cleaned when it is time to leave for Bobby's house. What will our mother do? The following are her two possible reactions. Reaction A, the bribe. If the children will be unable to go visit Bobby because the playroom is not cleaned up, then the mother's original after-then statement was truly a bribe, since the children were able to choose one of the two implied options. Option A, clean the playroom and go to Bobby. Option B, don't clean the playroom and don't go to Bobby. Thus, in this scenario, a trip to Bobby was a bribe. Reaction B, the lie. If the children will visit Bobby regardless of whether the playroom is cleaned or not, then the original after-then statement was dishonest. The children were told that they would not be going to Bobby until the playroom was cleaned up, and the truth was they would be going to Bobby either way. This inconsistency creates insecurity in children. Therefore, after-then statements and if-then statements are equally problematic and should not be used. Our school systems are liberal in their use of positive reinforcements because the educational environment commonly features a ratio of 25 to 30 children per one teacher. The added stress of curricular implementation, principals, supervisors, and deadlines creates a need for efficiency and immediate results. Therefore, teachers rely on the use of stickers and prizes to keep performance levels up, while at the same time juggling the demands of the classroom environment. It obviously is preferable that teachers use positive reinforcement techniques rather than negative ones during the learning process. Given the reality that children are bribed so frequently at school, it is even more crucial that they learn to do things at home solely because an authority, in this case a parent or caregiver, has instructed them to do so. The reduced adult-to-child ratio in the home and the absence of educational pressures allows home to be the environment where children can be taught the importance of doing the right thing for the right thing's sake. And what about charts? Are they for better or are they for worse? In general, chart systems neither benefit nor harm the chinuch process. Charts do not usually develop the long-lasting midos and life skills that we hope to cultivate in our children, but they do not cause harm either. There has rarely been a chart system that actually survived in a home environment. Usually the chart is discarded for lack of motivation, thus the real life skills that were its goal are not mastered. Instead, the charts are invariably neglected on the refrigerator after the initial excitement wears off. If you are presently using a chart system, you can permit it to continue until it is completed or simply allow it to die from disuse. There are actually times when bribery is helpful. Recommended bribing, however, must meet two criteria. 1. The bribe must only be used for situations where the outcome is so important that it will affect the child's future. Examples include a child who is struggling academically or spiritually and is resisting outside help. 2. It is best if a bribe includes quality time with a parent rather than merely a physical object. Since most children are overly endowed with a surplus of toys and games, they will not be interested in offers of additional objects. On the other hand, children usually need quality time with their parents and will therefore be most willing to cooperate in return for time alone with mommy and tati. If these two criteria are met, parents may implement a bribe. Maybe I can use this with Libby. He is struggling quite a bit in school. The reading specialist told me that he needs at least 3 private reading sessions a week in an individualized setting outside the mainstream classroom to bring his reading level up to par. Libby, however, is very resistant to leaving the classroom in the middle of class and refuses to comply. I know that reading is the foundation of all academics, and that if Libby does not receive the help he needs now, the problem will only become exacerbated as the years progress. So, I should probably say to Libby, it is important that you go with Mora R 3 times every week. When Mora R tells me that you went nicely to your sessions 15 times, you and I will go out together for ice cream. When parents learn that they may not use bribery to facilitate obedience, they often begin to wonder when it is appropriate to buy their children gifts. The frequency of this quandary demonstrates that parents primarily give their children physical items for the sole purpose of encouraging their performance. They are operating according to a system that mandates that their children must earn their gifts. Apparently, they seem to feel that gift-giving for any other reason is a waste. Once you change your attitude toward bribery and use it only when the 2 previously mentioned very specific criteria are met, You will be free to buy your children occasional gifts accompanied by loving words such as, "I thought of you in the store today. Here, this is for you." Giving a gift to a child, even a small gift, is a true gesture of love and is extremely meaningful to a child. Make use of this valuable tool by viewing it for what it is meant to be, an expression of love.